I want to speak for a few minutes about the new internal fissures on the political left and right in this country, fissures that have emerged in part because of September 11th and the Bush administration's war on terror. I do not believe that the war on terror has caused these fissures, but it has certainly brought them forcefully to our attention, and I want to argue that they are significant, much deeper than mere differences of opinion over foreign policy, and that they pose opportunities and dangers for American conservatism. What is new on the left? We are well prepared at the Philadelphia Society to mark what is new on the left, well prepared because we have been analysts of the left for some time. The story of leftism from the heady days of the 30s to today can only be read as a tragedy. I feel deep pity for my leftist friends today, fellow graduates of Oberlin College. In the beginning, the left was a moral movement, wrong-headed about economics, susceptible to Soviet lies, but driven nevertheless by deep moral concern. We must remember that Hayek devoted his road to serfdom to the socialists of all parties, and did so because Hayek himself was engaged in a moral political conversation with socialist friends, which is to say they shared a moral language. That language, however, has been largely abandoned, and the left can no longer be regarded as driven by moral principles. One longs for the days when one could debate with an old-fashioned Marxist about how best to bring about social justice. The old Marxists believed there was such a thing as justice, were bold enough to assert they knew what it was, and were willing to fight domestically and internationally to bring it about. How far the left has moved, how far it has fallen. The history of the modern left has unfolded, or unraveled as it were, in a number of stages. One can begin with the socialist moralists of whom I just spoke. By the 1960s, they were marginally but increasingly threatened by a growing moral relativism. One might have hoped that this facile relativism would have subsided as the 60s generation came of age, but it did not subside, or they refused to grow up. By the 80s, it had become nearly impossible for the left to affirm the moral motives that had driven old causes, precisely because they were moral motives. And because the old faith that some principles are worth fighting and dying for seemed at once intellectually problematic and unnecessarily bellicose. By the 90s, relativism looked more like nihilism. And today, the moral vacuum left by relativism and nihilism has been filled by hatred. Hatred of America. Hatred of free markets. Of Christianity. Of Republicans, and of Texas. This story of the left is not new to the Philadelphia Society. It has been commented upon by panelist after panelist at our national meetings. What has not been noticed or widely discussed is the effect this development has had on certain leftist intellectuals who are and always were moralist at heart. I am not speaking here simply of those prominent neoconservatives who have defected from the left. Perhaps the first was Irving Kristol. One thinks today of David Horowitz. I'm talking about leftists who have become radically alienated and frustrated by the left, but who still regard themselves, God bless them, as liberals. Figures like Christopher Hitchens, Jean Bethke Elshtain, Salman Rushdie, and Michael Walzer. If you have not yet read the essay by Walzer that appeared in the spring 2002 issue of Dissent magazine, you should. I recognize that you may not all be readers of Dissent magazine. It is entitled, Can There Be a Decent Left? And Walzer, the longtime editor of Dissent, complains, and I quote, leftist critique of US foreign policy, most clearly I think from the Vietnam years forward, has been stupid, overwrought, grossly inaccurate, a combination of embitterment and not thinking, the left has lost its bearings. Bemoaning the loss of decency among leftists, Walzer concludes his essay with the following remarkable confession. The American left has had an honorable history, and we have certainly gotten some things right, above all our opposition to domestic and global inequalities. But what the aftermath of September 11 suggests is that we have not advanced very far, and not always in the right direction. The left needs to begin again. This is Walzer. Walzer is only one of a growing number of dejected and despondent leftists. The postmodern left has moved so far away from its noble concerns that anyone who is still truly engaged in fighting moral battles has now more in common with conservatives than with liberals. One way to think about this phenomenon of leftist second thoughts, as Horowitz likes to call it, would be to view it as an opportunity to be seized, a dialogue we conservatives dare not refuse. I think this is right. But the changes in American politics are not occurring only on the left. They are occurring on the right as well. For various reasons, relating not, I think, to the degeneration of the right, but to changing circumstances, the right appears at this moment in our history more liberal, and I mean that in the 1930s sense of the word, I'm afraid, than ever. Why is that the case? The answer cannot be reduced to a single factor or event. The fissure developing on the right is not, in my view, identical to the oft-analyzed tension between neocons and traditional conservatives, though there is some overlap with that divide. That the fissure is more complicated should be evident from the large number of traditional conservatives who support the war on terror, the war in Iraq, and the current administration generally, in spite of unprecedented levels of domestic and international spending. Bush's support is not simply neoconservative support. I do not deny that prominent traditional conservatives, our own Klaus Wren among them, have spoken out vehemently against the war, and especially against Republican spending. I want to come back to the importance of those types of critique in a minute. But what needs explaining first is why some traditional conservatives do not share in the criticisms. What is happening on the right that would make some conservatives rethink appropriate spending levels and appropriate uses of American power abroad? The first and most obvious answer is precisely what the president has been saying, that September 11 changed things. September 11 simply opened many eyes to the reality of America's complicated involvement in the world, to American responsibilities, and to the vulnerability of the American way of life. To be a conservative after September 11 still meant to cherish tradition and to preserve American values. But preservation necessarily took on new forms because of the magnitude of the threat. For many conservatives today, the threats to American principles and American interests call for a different order of response. Our conservatism must become proactive. It is worth noting in passing why the extreme left has reacted so malevolently to this proactively conservative administration. It is because to preserve is to affirm. And the left cannot abide our affirmations. The more active our conservatism becomes, the more scandalized becomes the left. The more scandalized, the more strident. Never in my lifetime has the misanthropic nihilism of the left been so manifest. And I think, again, this is why the old leftist moralists feel so estranged. That is an aside. With respect to the right, were there time, I might attempt something like a philosophical analysis of the new proactive right, although I think it's too early still for that. But this must be said, its willingness to use government power extends beyond foreign policy, and therefore it must stem from something more fundamental than the events of September 11th. Why has the new right dramatically increased spending not only on the military and on homeland security, but also on education and healthcare? The answer must lie, it seems to me, either in unprincipled expedient bargaining with the left, that is the uncharitable answer, or it lies in the emergence of a modified conservative philosophy, less skeptical, less cynical of the potential for government to be a force for good. Bush's conservatism is, in fact, compassionate, conservatism, not only because Bush himself is compassionate, but also because the people in America and around the world want a government that can act upon compassionate impulses. Risks entailed by such government action, of course, abound, as libertarian and traditional conservative voices remind us. But the new right, while cautious, is simply more willing to endure those risks for the potential goods that are at stake. The philosophy of the new right is still, in my view, emerging, and my interest in analyzing it should not be mistaken for a defense of it. But it is emerging in the way a sound political philosophy should, in my view. Not abstractly from utopian dreams, but concretely from exigent circumstances. Not abandoning old principles, but modifying them cautiously and incrementally when they do no longer serve their purpose. Towards a new center. Either one of the two fissures I've been describing, the estrangement of moral leftists from the radically nihilist left and the emergence of a more active, compassionate conservatism on the right, either of these developments would be worthy of our attention at the Philadelphia Society. But it is the combination of the two that I wish to hold up for our reflection. The affinity between old leftists with the newly activist right can be seen clearly in a document like Jean Bethke Elshtain's What We Are Fighting For. It is an open letter in defense of the US war on terror signed by 60 prominent American intellectuals on the left and right. On the right, Robbie George, Harvey Mansfield, Michael Novak, Christopher Wolfe, James Q. Wilson, our very own Alan Carlson. On the left, Bill Gostin, Theda Scotchpaw, Michael Walzer, there are many more, Jean Elshtain herself, though I do not believe this one-time Democrat and feminist would identify herself today with the left. The text of What We Are Fighting For is worth consulting because it articulates certain core principles of Western, not to say human, flourishing. A conservative list of principles would run much longer, but it would include the items on Elshtain's list. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. The basic subject of society is the human person, and the legitimate role of government is to protect and help to foster the conditions for human flourishing. Human beings naturally desire to seek the truth about life's purpose and ultimate ends, truth. Freedom of conscience and religious freedom are inviolable rights of the human person. Killing in the name of God is contrary to faith in God and is the greatest betrayal of the universality of religious faith. It must indeed be a sad commentary on the contemporary left that such rudimentary truths cannot be more widely affirmed. You all know there was a list of 100 intellectuals who responded to this document. Against it, they were opposed to it. But the point I want to stress here is the great potential for dialogue with those leftist intellectuals who did sign the letter. These folks now have more in common with conservatives than they do with the left, whether they would admit it, like Elshtain, or deny it, like Michael Walzer and Christopher Hitchens. It does not matter what they call themselves, though. A conversation about shared values and strategies for cultural renewal is a dialogue we dare not refuse. My second point, my final point, would be to stress the dangers in this new alliance between moralist leftists and activist conservatives. It has never been more important for traditional conservatives to re-articulate as forcefully as possible the classic case for limited government and limited American intervention abroad. We need to be reminded now, more than ever, of the sensibility, of the sensible Augustinian skepticism about earthly progress. We need to be reminded of the errors of Gnosticism and rationalism, that the road to improvement may well be the road to serfdom, that compassionate intentions do not ipso facto translate into wise policies. Traditional conservative principles may well be modified by the immediacy and magnitude of the threats we face, but if principles are to be modified, they should be modified and not abandoned, and that requires knowing full well what our guiding principles have been. The purpose of the Philadelphia Society is clear. Edmund Burke, the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, Alexis de Tocqueville, G.K. Chesterton, Russell Kirk, Richard Weaver, F.A. Hayek, Wilhelm Röpke, Eric Voegelin, Michael Oakeshott, and of course, as ever, Aristotle. These are some of the writers we should be reading in these trying times, They will not tell us what to do, but they will remind us of who we are. And they will remind us, above all, that to be conservative is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the near to the distant, the convenient to the perfect, present laughter to utopian bliss. Some changes we may be forced, alas, to suffer. And principles must, of course, be amended from time to time, but we alter our principles like we mend a favorite sweater, seeking to preserve what is there already. And I close with a quote from Kirk. It is custom, convention, and old prescription that are checks both upon man's anarchic impulse and upon the innovator's lust for power. Thank you.